Hi, Internet. Melissa got cocked and ready. And just waited.
And he beat me to it.
Welcome to Unboxing Store. Well, first of all,
well,
I'm gone.
I don't know the intro thing.
Literally, it's one line.
And I mess it up all the time.
Okay. So, my name's John.
And I'm Melissa.
We're bro and
we're
going to
just not say our last name anymore because we keep disagreeing about how you pronounce it.
But the show is Unpacking Fiction Without the Friction. I also have on my Twitter bio that it's the Feel Good Fiction Podcast. I want to change it to that, but because the main point of this show is to talk about the things that we like and whether that's a television show.
And what makes them good stories.
Yeah. Whether it's a TV show or a game or a book. And today we're going to be talking about music and kind of the tone poetry that My Chemical Romance has done throughout their stuff, whether it's a music video or a TV show, comic book, song. And then we're going to go into Umbrella Academy specifically and the recent version of it that was on Netflix. So I decided that I wanted to start because My Chemical Romance was like the Beatles when I was younger. Like, every girl that I knew that was like emo or punk loved this band.
I want to look up what they look like.
Okay. My apologies if I knew you and you feel like I'm putting you on blast. But it was just interesting to me personally because it was a little bit a while before I started getting into rock music in general. I'm raised in a very conservative church, and so it wasn't like from day one our parents were like indoctrinating us with the music that they grew up with, right? And so
I don't know what mother you grew up with.
Listen, she was a lot crazier when she was raising you. I knew that she had music because I when I was in their room sometimes I would see, oh, they have all these cassettes. What are these?
What are these things?
I can see like Aerosmith.
Flat
and
round
stuff like
things
that
you put on. I don't understand.
Wait, what the? No, it says cassettes.
They had a lot of vinyl.
Oh, okay. Oh, I didn't see any of that. But then it wasn't until we went to see a tribute band for the Beatles. And that was the first thing that made me think about, oh, like there's this whole generation of music that I haven't been introduced to. So I started looking into classic rock stuff. But I met someone in middle school who gave me a lot of her CDs. Shout out to Valerie, if you're listening to this. She gave me Good Charlotte and Green Day, and that was actually one of the first things that happened to me at my middle school, was I was shadowing someone that was supposed to be, like, showing me Melissa playing with her figures.
I'm listening.
Just a little bit ADD.
A little bit. I told him I could only be a four today, okay? That's all I got. So
I was shadowing someone, and the first thing that he asked me was, have you heard American Idiot yet? And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. But that's how I found Green Day and like found out that there was this whole pop punk thing happening. And what's interesting to me about it is that it's pop punk. It's like a contradiction in terms. There's like this whole like counterculture that our parents grew up in, and somewhat in your generation, like Gen X, there was a lot of punk rock stuff happening, but it was actually like anti-establishment. Like,
yeah,
there was a point to it that you were F the man, and like I'm defining, you know, what being cool is for myself, and whether that was like your generation with like this straight edge vegan stuff, and it's very political that way. And well, just looking at me like I'm crazy. These things happen.
No, I believe you. I know.
And
I
then
know.
Mom's generation with like anti-war, anti, you know, Nixon, like there's a lot of things that were actually being said.
Yes.
Whereas in my generation, it's just boy bands that do rock music pretty much. Like, so what was funny is that I liked the music and there were certain bands that I liked more than others, I started noticing that there was this thing that was like, there's punk music and there's metal. And I didn't really listen to a lot of metal. It seemed like there was more of that, as like, metal was going to claim itself as, like, we're sticking to the roots of rock, and it was, like, carrying on some of Gen X to be more like, this is, hard rock.
Right.
And then there's pop punk as this kind of more mainstream thing. And then My Chemical Romance was emo.
Yes.
That was the first, like, that was the defining band of that sound. And to me, it just seemed like it was kind of like, we're going to sing about our emotions. And it was very whiny. It seemed to me like,
that's why,
you know,
I was not really into it. I don't like whiny music.
Uh-huh. And specifically, even the sound of it, like the sound of the singing was, in some of those bands, was very like high-pitched, and it just wasn't something that resonated with me. I my favorite band during that time was Green Day. I liked the idea of this kind of hard rock thing that was, and they were very, like, in the lyrics, it was very anti-war and stuff. So it seemed like they, even though it wasn't really deep in any sense, it was still like they had some kind of message there. And so I didn't really listen to My Chemical Romance at the time. Now looking back on them and Fall Out Boy and stuff, I'm starting to notice that there is some lyrical skill there. And that just because I didn't like the sound that they had at the time, now that rock has, like, pretty much disappeared. There's, like, Paramore and Foo Fighters, and that's pretty much it in terms of classic.
Yeah,
like,
actual rock.
We have drums and guitars.
Yeah, we
and
actually
stuff
play
like that.
The music.
Because, like Imagine Dragons has, like, they have the look of a rock band.
Right, but it's
but
not
they
necessarily.
Don't, and they there's a lot of, like, trap and EDM that's in a lot of production now. And it pretty much all kind of sounds some amalgamations of the same type of thing. So looking back on MCR stuff, especially Welcome to the Black Parade, there is a kind of like prestige thing of like, we're still trying to keep rock and roll alive in some way. This might be our brand of it, but it was interesting looking back on it. What actually happened was there's a comedy sketch thing that I caught the tail end of on YouTube called Jake and Amir. And to do like this tribute thing before they ended their show, they just took the first episode that they ever uploaded and cut out the audio and put Welcome to the Black Parade in it. And it's like a clip show of all their stuff. And so it was funny because I didn't earn any of the emotions that I had watching it because I had barely seen any of their content. But I had this feeling of like, that is my generation's music. Like, people are going to reference My Chemical Romance from now on.
Right.
And so it would be interesting to look back on it. And when I did, I was like, well, okay, this isn't just, like, Fall Out Boy had a lot of kind of, like, things about relationships, like, thanks for the memories, and I hope, like, when you leave this town, you find some guy that's better than me and stuff like that. That you can interpret as just, like, kind of whiny nerds doing rock and roll music.
I didn't think they sounded whiny. We'll
get to them.
Yeah. He's picking on people I like now. I don't really know.
But that's the funny thing about you, too, is that you had no reason to seek out these people.
Yeah, no.
And now that some of them are bigger, you're kind of appreciating some of the music that I grew up around. Like, I didn't necessarily listen to all of it. But anyway, so I looked, and especially looking back on Welcome to the Black Parade, I noticed, like, wow, there's a lot of actual, like, symbolism in here. Specifically, like, after graduating college, I took an Irish literature class. And one of the symbols that's a favorite Irish one is the widow. And the widow as this symbol of, like, the pride of the Irish people, right? And so as we get into the lyrics of Welcome to the Black Parade, it seemed to me like a more interesting, well, okay, before we get into all this, is there anything that you can remember from this pop punk time or was it just completely not in your stratosphere?
When I was in college then? Is that the era we're talking about?
Yeah, so it's like when I was in middle school.
Oh, so probably high school. Well, yeah.
I was in middle school from like 2003 to 2007.
I forgot how young you are. You know, I was in college, and I wasn't doing much with music at that time. Mm-hmm. And up until I left college, I was still very much into sappy pop stuff. Mm-hmm. So I have very weird musical experience.
Uh-huh.
So it was all very sappy pop stuff or classic rock because mom was into it.
Uh-huh.
And I liked some of that. Or I don't know what other stuff.
I think that's the thing is that I think there's different levels of musical interest. And I think personally, because I like movies and comics and books as my like escapism, it's not like I grew up listening to, I didn't go to buy albums. I didn't save up money to go to concerts.
I very rarely did. I remember the first one I actually went and purposely found was New Kids on the Block, but that was high school. That was before.
Yeah, this is why we're going to get into company.
No, I know. I'm just saying. There weren't very many I purposely went for or asked for.
Uh-huh.
The other ones were stuff was, you probably remember The Party. Nobody remembers The Party. They were on for like 6 months.
Remember The Party. Okay.
But anyway.
Did you know of any goth or punk kids?
I knew goth and punk kids, but I didn't know what music they listened to.
Because
We were, I mean, they were, I didn't, I wasn't not friends with them, but I wasn't like buddy-buddy with them either.
My favorite thing about your generation that I think of all the time is my brother-in-law, Derek, told us that he was friends with those kids when he was in school, and that one person came up to him and said, if I shoot up this school, I'm going to save your life, or something like, I'm going to make sure that you don't get hurt.
Yay.
And that was such a funny thing, because it was like, being from a conservative background, it's kind of funny that, like, that was kind of my thing, is that, like, I didn't feel myself as, like, I want to be one of the popular kids, because I perceived that as, you're friends with them, you go to these parties where you're drinking.
Right, and it's very
like
frivolous
that.
Nonsense, and we're like, eh,
right.
Whatever.
And so, like, being
so this
with
is
all
how
these...
bad it was. I went to a very nerdy high school,
uh-huh.
as it is. I went to
oh, right. yeah.
what they call a magnet high school,
uh-huh.
which in Philadelphia they're allowed to kick you out of if your grades go south.
Right.
And I was with the nerdy group of kids in that high school. So I was quintessential nerdy in the mid-90s. So you can picture that however you want to. It was just as bad as you think, I am sure. So there's that.
I think that that's the big thing about the emo boom of my youth was that it was about... It wasn't like, this is about trying to, like, the music isn't anti-government necessarily. It's not like, let's all shoot up and forget about our lives or whatever. It's more like, they all also call it mall rock or something. Because it's all about, like, these suburban kids that want to have their music, right? It's like these kids having their counterculture music. And so it's safe enough that it's like you can listen to it in your room and your mom won't think like, why is there like something like Marilyn Manson. It's not like this androgynous witch person
right.
like is talking about, you know, killing yourself. And
right.
Stuff
because
like that.
They wanted to counter. So these are the children of baby boomers. Right.
Uh-huh.
So these are people who have parents who are hippies.
Right.
And who were into classic rock.
Right.
And everything was very, you know, you got to grow up and get a stiff upper lip and do what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
So their version of counterculture was, no, we're going to be whiny kids for as long as possible.
Right.
That's my sad opinion of this.
Yeah.
I apologize if that offends anybody. But as somebody who was tail end of Gen X, because I really don't identify as much with millennials, I was like in the middle. It was like you saw this transition between the people who were all into heavy metal and goth stuff, like for real, to a bunch of kids that were dressing like that, mm-hmm. and claiming it was their thing.
Right.
But not really doing it.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, so before we get into the lyrics...
Which I think then also then evolved into the hipster thing of, like, we're going to be into this ironically.
Uh-huh.
At least they're acknowledging that they're not into the thing for real. They're doing it for a different reason.
I think using...
Youth are weird. That's what I got to say. Young people are strange. All right,
before you go on a rant, I'm going to use Fall Out Boy as a barometer because I feel like it's like comparing Lewis Carroll to Edgar Allan Poe.
Hmm.
Like, their lyrics are good in the sense that they have a certain sense of poetry to them, right? But especially the more they got popular, it seemed like they weren't really as concerned about... I guess you could say, like, they're concerned about putting out quality stuff in a regular interval as opposed to creating some kind of, like, concept for what their band
should
be.
Yeah.
Right. So what's interesting about them is that they've survived and been able to
thrive. I think their music is even really good. Like, I think their music is accessible enough. So it's not, that's the thing. The problem with being a commercial musician is you have to be able to sell what you're making.
Right.
Which part of the punk originally culture was, we don't care how much we're selling. We have six people that come to see us
and
clubs.
And it started getting popular at a time when you could just be like part of some indie label.
Right.
And because there was less access to stuff, you could like do crazy stuff like mail out your albums.
Right.
And then you got to define what punk
was because there was
a group of, you know.
But now it's very much the internet culture and everything,
yeah.
and you still need to get and
right.
have access to getting a bunch of people in a different way. But anyway, so need to make the music accessible enough so that even if it's not people that are like just solid punk band followers,
right.
that they would still like the music, even if they don't necessarily like the whole thrust of what the band is about. Because personally, I think they have more of a message than like, say, Imagine Dragons, which has really cool music and some good poetry, but it's very much not a... like a specific thing.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
What I mean?
And I think, I mean, all music is subjective and there are certainly like different, like with storytelling in general, there's different things that you can glom onto and think this is what I resonate with. Right. And so what I appreciated looking back on My Chemical Romance is that it seemed like no matter what they were doing, they had a specific, thing that they were going for. And so part of it was, like, they were trying to look at high school culture, and they would do these weird things, like, in their music videos. They would have cheerleaders with, like, gas masks on. And in, like, Umbrella Academy, there's this idea of, like, this prep school where this mad scientist dad is like, I'm going to teach you all how to be superheroes. And they're all kind of, like, weird versions of, like, old classics, you know, sci-fi and fantasy tropes. With this song, what it seems like, Welcome to the Black Parade, what it means to me is that in this time, let me see what the song was released. In this, like, post 9/11 world,
2006.
Yeah, 2006. What was interesting is that there were, unlike in like Mom's Generation, there weren't really a lot of bands that were trying to be like the voice. Like you had like the Dixie Chicks and certain people that were very outspoken about their stance. But from my perception as a kid, there weren't many popular artists that were trying to say, you know, in their music, why fighting in the... It seems like there were just a lot of people that were struggling to come up with some way of voicing kind of an anti-war sentiment, right? And so looking at this song in retrospect, I think it's a really nice, like, personal way of talking about what it's like to be a part of this generation while a war is going on. Instead of just Bush sucks or like, for example, Green Day's Wake Me Up When September Ends and in the video specifically, it's setting up this thing where it's this kind of like tragic romance thing, where it's like it's a woman whose husband or boyfriend or whatever is going off to war, and so it's her. It's kind of like framing it as, wake me up when all this is over, and can we survive this thing together? This seems to be much more messy in the sense that, like, it's trying to sound like an anthem, but it also is very morbid. And what I appreciate about it is that it's not morbid in this, like, Tim Burton-y way, where it's, like, you know, talking about, like, dead soldiers, like, dancing or something like that. Some weird, like, thing that's just morbid for the sake of being morbid. It seems like it's really doing a lot of work to make it a personal tragedy feeling to it. Because it opens with the image of a young boy and his father saying, you're going to be the next, almost like chosen one thing, and you're going to be the savior of the world. But the song is more about his disillusionment with this.
Disillusionment?
There we go.
I agree with the disillusionment part. But I kind of felt like the beginning was more about, as a generation, feeling like the generation before you is giving you this hope.
Uh-huh.
One thing a lot of people said about Gen Xers was, we kind of gave up. Uh-huh. We, like, saw what the generation before did, and they basically handed us a whole bunch of mess and said, uh-huh, you guys are going to fix this, and we're right. Like... okay. That was kind of the way our whole generation dealt with stuff, as we shrugged and went back to typing on our computer to try and figure out what was happening, you know, spelling it. But then millennials were a very hopeful group.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of feels to me like this, like, yeah, you know, this is going to be hard, and there's going to be a lot of beaten down and broken people in the world, and you're going to go out there and save them. Like, you are the hope for our future.
Uh-huh.
Kind of thing. Still knowing, though, that this kind of end, I considered it death. You're calling it war.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, the big, dark, looming parade that is on the horizon is inevitable, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's coming anyway. You're joining it. It's not just like, you're going to go stop this parade. That's not what he asks him to do.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I'm going to lead you to join it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like you have to become part of this dark future, even though I think you have a chance of fixing things.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
yeah,
that's kind of how I felt with
the
beginning.
Well, what's
there.
Interesting is that the genius, it's become like one of the biggest lyrics providers, I guess you could say. But they talk about how the Black Parade is a concept album, and that the patient is a man who's dying, and he has this strong memory of, so Gerard Way, who's the front man of My Chemical Romance, says that death comes for you however you want, and I feel that it's your strongest memory. So he wanted to portray a child that is remembering a parade, but when the parade comes for him, it's the Black Parade, and it's taking him away. So I think that what's interesting about it, though, is that you can read into it this idea of, like, what you're saying, this generational passing of the torch. And I think what's interesting about their band is that, and it's kind of personified in this song, is that you get this overwhelming sense of morbidity. Like, there's a lot of, like, you could say, like, it's kind of like the idea of, like, what if Loki came to you with a present, and you're just like, I don't know if I can trust this.
Right.
So, like, I think what's interesting about it is that you can perceive the lyrics as being, like, is death trying to trick you in the sense that, like, is it really a parade? Like, is this really a joyful occasion?
Right.
But like you're saying, like, the chorus of we're going to carry on, it's so well done and such a good composition that it does actually make you feel good.
Right.
Like, it's this cathartic song. And so I think what's interesting about it is that you can both get this idea of there's like they're in the promises in the beginning of the song that you're gonna be defeating all the demons and non-believers and all the stuff. Like, I think you can still question those things, but instead of that being something that makes you a nihilist, it's more like you're saying this message of hope, like where we can be the leaders of this parade. And it's interesting that a lot of the people that like this band, like, I got along with, and they were nice people. And, like, I think a lot of the caricature of goth people is that they're all like that guy that was saying to Derek that
right.
he was going to
shoot up
the school.
That wasn't most of them that I knew either. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, in the bridge there, there's a lot of bridges in this song, talking about, like, how they're going to carry on. They're not going to be ashamed. They're going to show their scars. It's like, we know we're going to go through all this rough stuff. But we're going to keep going anyway. And it's now that I'm talking about it, and if we're thinking of it as death or whatever dark thing is facing humanity, the idea that, yes, it's rough and, yes, it's terrible, but we as a people are going to keep going, even though it breaks us up, even though it, you know, breaks our hearts, whatever it does to us, they're going to keep going.
Right. And I love my favorite, I think, part of the song is, listen here, because it's who we are. I'm just a man, I'm not a hero. Just a boy who had to sing this song. I'm just a man, I'm not a hero. I don't care. And
right.
So, like, there's this really cathartic point where he's talking about, like how one generation treats you, like you're going to be the thing that fixes everything.
Right.
And he's just like, I don't care what you think I am. I'm owning this for myself, kind of thing. And it's just an interesting thing because it's not really didactic either way. It's not this complete punk anthem of like, screw you, you know.
No, it's more of
better
a,
than you.
We're gonna carry on. We can't fix all this, but we're gonna keep going anyway.
Right. So that I think that's a nice way of doing it as opposed to being really nihilist and being really anti.
Right. And just being like, no, I'm going to join this parade and give up.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that. I'm going to keep marching.
Right.
But we should go to the mineral.
Okay, yes.
And then when we come back, we will talk about Umbrella Academy,
the
which, now that I am all riled up, might involve some ranting. So,
okay.
We'll all be right. Back.
Look forward to it. We talked about
Robot. We're back. Robot Moms.
You're talking about Robot Mom.
And the
if you haven't seen I Am Mother on Netflix, please watch
you
it.
You should watch it.
That's
good.
The end of that segment. So I saw Umbrella Academy on the stands. I remember it being there, but I did not purchase it. But I just thought it was cool that I think it's Gabriel Aha, I think is his name, was the artist on the book, and Gerard Way wrote it. And it was kind of cool to see a rock person doing a comic, and it seemed like he was taking, like I said, that style that he had from the music videos that they did into a comic thing. Like, it was a very, it looked to me like a punk comic. And they've had videos where they wear, like, the prep school clothes. So that kind of reminded me of those music videos where they were dressing like they were in a prep school. But you were the one who watched this whole thing.
Yes.
So
you didn't watch the whole thing?
The floor. Not the whole thing.
No.
I watched the beginning, middle, and end. But I did not see some of the episodes in between.
Okay.
So please enlighten our viewers. Listeners.
So it begins with the father of this family dying. And all the kids start coming back.
Well, no. Let's set up the weird way that this... The preamble. Where... There's, like, a Russian chick and a Russian guy in this, like, swimming pool. And there's, like...
I don't remember this part.
Okay, well, there's, like... It's so funny because they're kind of, like, flirting. They're, like, sitting at the side of the pool. And then, all of a sudden, the girl dives. And the minute that she dives, she starts screaming. And it turns out, like, they just... She, like, pecked him on the cheek or they kissed, like, real quickly. And all of a sudden, she's pregnant.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just so funny because the guy's eyes were
yes.
What the heck?
So let me back up. I forgot about the beginning that they tell you all these things. There was a specific day when forget how many, but a certain number of women. No, it was more than, it was a lot. It was like 60 something.
Oh, right. That was another, I'll get to that.
There's a whole bunch of women that instantaneously became pregnant.
Right.
All around the world and gave birth the same day. And there was this guy who ran around the world trying to purchase the children.
Because it says like some random number, like 160 kids.
160,
were born,
and he got seven.
He got seven.
So this random dude that you have never heard of, this eccentric old rich man, buys seven children that were born at this specific time.
Yeah.
And raises them in his mansion. And you eventually learn, as they are all coming back to for his funeral, A, they are a very dysfunctional family because they were all adopted from all over the place.
Right.
B, he raised them as superheroes. Mm-hmm. Like, they were their own little superhero team with masks and everything.
Like, very incredible.
Yes. Except for the youngest, number seven. He actually didn't even... You don't hear them, their names, for a while. They're numbered. Number seven does not, so far as anyone knows, have powers. And so she was kind of left out of a lot of stuff.
Right.
Played by Ellen Page, the awesome. And so they each have different abilities. One of them is super strong.
Mm.
One of them is she can control you with her voice.
Mm.
There's one that, I don't know, there's a bunch of different stuff. Oh, there's the sneaky dude with the knives. He can chuck knives and they go wherever
right.
he wants them to go. And then there's the one that does time-bendy stuff who has disappeared.
Uh-huh. Oh, and also my favorite thing from the trailer was that there was a talking monkey.
Oh, yes. And they have a house servant who happens to be an elevated chimp.
For those of you who like comics, you'll know that randomly during the Silver Age of comics, there was this random trend of having talking monkeys in your thing. And
so
it
let's
was
just
so
throw
funny.
A talking monkey in there.
What's his name? The Flash villain. Solomon? No. Solomon Grundy is different. Dang it.
The Big Ape thing from the Ape Planet?
Yeah, so that was one that actually survived and has continued to be in comics.
I don't
comics.
Get it. Really don't.
I just think it's a fun, like,
oh,
it
and their
fun.
Mom.
Oh, yeah. It was,
who you fairly early figure out is robotic.
Yes.
Because she's
also
very Stepford Wives. No, it's not cute. It's creepy.
Well, she wasn't, like...
Well, she wasn't maniacal or anything.
Didn't, like, slap her around or something.
No,
like.
It was just creepy.
Yes, she was creepy.
But anyway, so you start to see all of their... insecurities, all of their childhood issues that are now coming up again because they're all back at the same house. They're trying to figure out... Oh, so then the one brother shows up. One of them is dead. And I don't know that they ever tell you how the one dies.
Oh, well...
Number five, I think, is dead. I'm not sure why.
Because there is one that is a drug addict who can communicate with the dead.
Yes.
So it's through him
to
find out.
That you find out.
One of
the
other ones is dead.
Is dead.
And
he sees his ghost all the time. He's hilarious. I love the druggy brother. He's the bomb.
He seems like he would be a favorite character of yours.
He's a riot. And very traumatized, obviously, because he talks to ghosts. It's a little creepy. Anyway, so the time-traveling brother shows up as a kid still. The rest of them are all grown up now, but he's still,
A 50-year-old man stuck in an
8-year-old boy's body. But he tells them that the world is going to blow up and they need to stop it. So there's all kinds of interesting tropes in this story.
Mm-hmm.
Like John was saying, they do have a lot of superhero trope type. Each of them has a familiar type of superhero. But each of them has different problems because of it. So, the oldest one, who was the strong one, his father actually got... Not bored. It's the wrong word. He was so worried that he was going to try and fix everything that he sent him to the moon to get him out of the way. Even though he believed he was up there for a reason.
Right.
But really, there wasn't any reason for him to be up there. He was just on the moon to get him out of the way of everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And let me say, the special effects for him... of making him look really big, even though it's very obvious that the actor is not just
is
not that huge.
It's because it's abnormal.
It was very funny because it was played straight. They didn't make fun of the fact that he was that big. It was just the fact that he was this huge, mammoth of a dude.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll keep interjecting.
then there's interesting stuff like the woman who can control you with her voice. Her husband found out that she was doing that to their daughter. Because if any mother out there will understand that there are times where you wish you could just make your child go to sleep. And she was doing stuff like that. Like, using her voice control to make her kid behave.
Right.
And the husband took the kid and left.
Right.
And I forget why.
Well, now that I know that, that actually seems a lot more justified than...
Yeah.
Than if it was just, like, they didn't get along or something.
Right. The druggy one is obviously on drugs because he talks to dead people, and who wouldn't be? So he's a little more obvious of a one. The... one with the knives is one of the few that's actually still out there fighting crime. Like, he goes around and still does stuff, even though the cops keep yelling at him that he shouldn't be doing stuff.
Not to interrupt you,
mm-hmm.
you can keep going, but what I really want to know is what the deal was with Mary J. Blige and her oafish partner, and what the two, like, kind of secret agents.
Oh, those guys. So... while they're sneaking around trying to deal with this explosion that they don't want to happen, you realize that there is this adjustment bureau kind of thing, this organization that exists outside of time.
Okay.
And they ensure that certain things happen. There are certain things that are supposed to happen in the timeline, and they make sure it happens.
Oh.
And so the two secret agents are working for this agency.
Right.
And every now and then they get random... pneumatic tube deliveries of things that they're supposed to be doing, like they're supposed to be assassinating people or stopping the heroes from doing what they're supposed to be doing, that kind of stuff.
They're like watchers, but more hands on.
Yes.
Okay. Very good.
So that's their deal.
Yep.
Which was also very interestingly done because the one kid pretends to work for them for a while. So they have whole scenes up in this office with this crazy,
I saw some of that.
Over-controlling blonde lady that is kind of freakish. But anyway.
Wasn't that Laura Dern from...
I don't know these people's names.
It's the chick from Jurassic Park.
Is it?
Yeah, Laura Dern. I thought it was. Or no.
I don't think it was.
Okay.
But anyway.
I will admit that...
The thing that intrigued me or that I thought was... No, not intrigued, because I was going to rant. So, the troublesome trope... for me in this, because all the rest of it I thought was very unique and very creative, the way they did it and the way they interacted with each other, is this one child that supposedly has no powers.
Uh-huh.
And mostly what she does is play violin. And she's okay at it, right? But she's having trouble actually getting in anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
She's trying to be first chair violin in her group, and then...
Oh, it was Kate Walsh.
Kate Walsh.
The chick from... she was in... Private Practice, I think. And she's a character actor from network TV. I thought it was Laura Dern. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Nope, it's okay. So then there is somebody who is obsessed with her, and I don't remember exactly now who did it.
Hmm.
That's terrible. But they kill the first chair so that she can be first chair.
There you go.
And start doing... Oh, it's a dude that's obsessed with her.
I kept thinking it was Captain... What the heck is his name? The guy in Rogue One? I kept seeing him.
Oh,
and
no, it's not Ando, because I'd have been all kinds of over that if it was.
Yeah.
I love that man so much. Diego Luna is the bomb. It was not him.
Okay.
But it was some other psychotic dude who was obsessed with her.
Was that the guy that was with her in, like, the park thing?
Yeah.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Who was trying to, you know, help her out and realizes he's doing crazy stuff to do that. But she also then starts discovering that she can, in fact, she does have a power. She can do all kinds of crazy things, most of which is like mass emotional control.
Right.
So when she starts playing violin and the first time you see the power is taking effect, she starts playing the song and everyone in the audience feels what she is feeling. Mm. Like, it just spreads everywhere.
Right.
So, but it can get to a very crazy level where it starts like... ripping apart space-time.
So I think I agree with you in the sense that, like, when I saw that there were seven kids, one of them does not have powers, I wonder where this is going to go.
Yeah, right? Like, it's
so,
like...
The first time was weird because I very much liked the tone of the show. Like, it ends with them all dancing to...
Oh, yeah, in their rooms. They put on, like, some 80s song or 90s song, and they're all chilling. I forget what it is.
And so, like, that, it was a cute thing. And it was, like, it was interesting that they're setting this up as, like, this is a superhero show, but it's all about them being a family, right? But the fact that the one character that is, like, the oddball out is, has that very recognizable trope of, like, she doesn't have her powers, she's gonna discover them. It was kind of like every other character is more interesting than her character.
Right.
And they didn't really sell me on, okay, she, so they also said that she wrote, like, a tell-all book.
Right. Oh, that's right. Everybody. She wrote a book about everybody, about what it was like to grow up with them.
So it was kind of sad because it seemed to me like they were pastiching the core demographic of who's watching the
right.
show.
Right.
Like, if you're going to think about emo kids watching this thing that Gerard Way wrote and is now being made into a Netflix show, why would you make the emo kid the one that wrote all this bad stuff
right.
without
everybody else?
And it's just kind of sulking around waiting to get superpowers.
Right. And it's even, it's the extent of they purposely hid her powers from her.
Oh.
So that she wouldn't do, because she was doing stuff not realizing she was doing stuff. Like, she would get mad at, it was, so the creepy, one part of the creepy parts with the mom. She kept getting different governesses, right, basically, nurses, whatever. And she would get angry at them and throw them across the room. So the dad eventually built the mom, because she's the only one that would survive
right.
this child.
Right.
And then eventually he has the older sister come down and tell her to forget her powers.
Hmm.
So that's why she totally forgets that she...
So let me frame this as a question then. What... I've been kind of thinking about this because there's a content creator that I like that was going on a rant about books. There was a YA book club that got started and he was real angry. Because it's like the whole thing he was saying is that that the publishing industry has a diabetes problem. That's like they're all eating cake, thus hollow and sweet stuff. And that the problem with doing that is that eventually you're going to have to get limbs cut off. So his way of saying this was making this point of, like, you have these things, like, in the J.J. Abrams stuff and throughout, like, sci-fi and comics and fantasy and stuff like that, that is, like, on the surface level, an emotional tie. There's some emotional core to it. But there are some authors that are more rigorous than others in the sense that they flesh it out. Like, we're watching Breaking Bad.
Right.
There are a lot of very three-dimensional characters in that show. And it's not like Shakespeare.
No.
Like, it doesn't have to be hoity-toity to be interesting, right?
Yeah.
So with this, what I would want to ask is, what, like, I like the tone of it. I like how it's directed and the music and stuff like that. But in terms of the emotions in it, is there anything about that character, even just since the trope has been done over and over again, that makes it different? Like, what is it about her character? Does it seem to explain why she just went all this time without seemingly just sitting there waiting for this arc to happen?
Right, right.
Is there something that shows, like, this character is different than all the other characters like that? Or
I don't think so. It kind of makes her look very self-deprecating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she wants to be part of the family.
Uh-huh.
But she is always excluded and told that it's dangerous for her. Like, she can't go out there because she would get hurt.
Right.
And kind of just feels like she's not part of the family because of that.
Right.
And then it's just very down on herself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So,
like,
I think that one ways that I've seen this done well.
But
is,
I mean, to be fair, it's Ellen Page. And if anybody's going to play self-deprecating in a way that
the actress
is fantastic, I don't think it's her fault.
Doing that.
It's just, this is, like, everybody else has more interesting issues that they're dealing
right.
with. And hers is just, oh, nobody likes me.
Because I think one way I've seen that done well is there's a character who is actually, because they're different, people are actually reaching out to them, but they don't, out of pride, they don't accept that. And so I was thinking, maybe, is it trying to go that direction with it?
No.
Or is it just more or less, she's just around, and...
Because it feels very much like that you all left me out of the family. I'm going to write this book and at least try and make some money out of this.
Uh-huh.
And then they stopped talking to her.
Right.
Because they wrote this book. So it's very much just a, like, fine, I'll be out of your family. And it's like,
yeah.
You know. But the trope of female superhero who does not know her own powers, finds her powers and blows the world up,
uh-huh.
is, I think, hopefully getting old and we need a new one. Guys,
it's been 30 years, or almost 40 years.
So we've had, I mean, and to be fair, there's not tons of them that I know of, but all the big ones, all the really, you know, huge female superheroes, which there aren't very many anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So Wonder Woman is not like that, at least. Wonder Woman knows what she is.
Yeah.
But Jean Grey and Captain Marvel were both that way, where they had amazing powers that they didn't, although Captain Marvel thankfully didn't blow up the world.
Uh-huh.
She used hers for good.
Right.
But there's still this trope of, like, your power is too great, we have to hide it from you.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because you obviously can't
and
handle
I
it.
I think it's the dual, it's like wanting to have their cake and eat it too. There's this weird thing of, like, historically women are not perceived as powerful. So, a way that we're going to show this is
right.
that there's somebody
been
who is
repressed.
Being repressed in some way. But I think what, like you're saying with, like, for example, the X-Men Red series, it's very refreshing to see a character who is being welcomed in as the leader.
Right.
And is seen as competent as a woman.
Right.
And it's not necessarily that they're not being challenged at all, but there's at least, like, this surface level thing of, like, we're not going to question this person just because they're a woman. And we're not going to belabor the point of, oh, this person is struggling so much to come over the thing. Because with any male character, be it Superman or Spider-Man or Batman or any of these people, it's not always, like, sometimes it comes up, but it's not usually the struggle that
they can't control
their powers
right.
or something.
Like, the only one I can think of off the top of my head that is like that is the Hulk.
Uh-huh.
But because that one is anger, it makes more sense as a male
uh-huh.
thing that a man
yeah.
would lose. Like, if you're going to say a man loses control of his emotions, it's usually he loses his temper.
Right.
As opposed to the female characters where it's like, you get emotional, period, you have problems.
Right.
They even do that with Storm. When Storm's emotional, the weather freaks out.
Right.
Like, you don't think she can make sure that it's not raining when she's crying? Like, come on, people. She's, like, been doing this for
yeah.
ages. Like, get a grip. Like, it's not...
And usually they've been good about her being... Like, even during the Dark Phoenix saga that we... That's a previous episode. Our
Check
live episode. Please listen. What I liked about her character in that was that she sees Jean Grey as, like, a sister. And it was nice that she was just there as another player in this story. It wasn't like... She was saying, like, as a woman, I have this perspective on this thing. She was just another one of the people that are just like, gee, I hope Jean Grey doesn't kill us all.
Oh, hey, I just thought of an example, because I just watched the first season of Heroes again, and it's been a long time.
Uh-huh.
The one that can't control his powers in that is Peter.
Hmm. Very true.
Peter doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't understand what the deal is. He just thinks, oh, when another superhero is around, I can do what they do.
Right.
He doesn't understand that he is gathering all of them and is eventually going to get ones that he can't control. So, like, he gets
uh-huh.
the radioactive thing, and he, if he freaks out, he can't control it.
Right. And I think that what I've noticed now that you're rewatching that is how many of the things are talking about mental health. So, like,
right.
with him, his dad committed suicide.
Right.
And what's interesting is that even though the cheerleader and the schizo lady are both, they're more passive in terms of, like, there's a weird thing with their powers where, like, for example, Allie Larder's character, she has multiple personality disorder, one of which is, like, this
super
killer chick. And, like, her regular personality is just, like, mom. So what's interesting about it, though, is that it's not, like, this... It's not, like, the powerful character is the good feminist ideology thing. It's, like, no, this person has multiple personality disorder, and it would be very much good for her if she could just not do that. And then with the cheerleader character, just a fact of her thing is that she can withstand all the stuff.
Yeah.
So I think what's interesting about it is that it's not playing with that woman struggling to be competent thing.
Right.
Like, it's just these characters are dealing with the same types of emotional struggles.
And it's all of them. All of the heroes in that show are having issues because they're like, oh my word, what is going on? And very few of them have any control of it at all. And the few that do are kind of psychopaths. So Siler knows what's going on and he's using it to kill other people. He's a freak.
Yeah.
Mentally, he's a freak, not just because he's got bones. But anyway, so that was an interesting one that I did manage to find where they had a male who was having emotional problems and that was causing his powers to flee. But it tends to be a female thing. So, and I'm over it. So write something different, guys. But other than that, I really, like you're saying, I enjoyed the tone and the cinematography in that show was really cool. I'm really hoping there's a second season only because of the reveal that they did at the end of the season as to where they all came from. I want to know what is going on with that. Because, I'm not going to tell you. But you need to watch the end of the first season and write me your theories as to what that was. Because that was, I don't even know if it was the very end. Somewhere towards the end. You find out where they came from.
I would say that from my viewing of it, it seemed like I appreciated the fact that even though superheroes are very popular and this is a brand that they're bringing back out of the woodworks to do with everything, I was glad that it seemed like it maintained a lot of its personality and that they were allowing like the directors that came onto it to do really cool things that weren't just retreads of like The Incredibles or something. Like, they weren't, it seemed like they were really allowing it to be its own thing. And so like there was like, you know, kind of black humor where the kid is at this donut shop.
He's
getting shot all over the place. And there was this kind of like weird, like the donut shop owner or the waitress there and the one secret agent guy had this kind of weird romance because it seems like she's like 20 or 30 years his senior. And they're like, they have this very like classic.
Oh yeah, the bird watching lady.
Yeah,
I liked the bird watching lady.
It's kind of like Casablanca type romance.
Yeah,
even though she's clearly like very old.
She's not that old. I don't think she was that much older. I just think she looked like more worn than him. You know what I mean?
Well, all that to say,
anyway,
that it was interesting because it wasn't just like two 20 something.
No, it wasn't.
I think
like
that's
some,
the biggest part.
Some,
that,
yeah, chintzy, sappy,
and usually, if they're going to do an age difference, it's the man being older than the woman.
Right.
So that was an interesting twist on that. And, like, Mary J. Blige being this kind of like love-hate relationship with
him. Oh, with the partner, yeah.
As her partner.
That I liked a lot. I liked their plot because they go back and forth. Like, they kept getting different orders all the time. So they're like, oh, we got to go kill this person. Oh, we got to go handle this now. And it would keep blowing up in their faces because there's superhero kids trying to stop them. So then it got to the point where they were both sent a message to kill each other, but you don't know who sends, like at the beginning, you're not sure who's sending them. And then you start to realize that the kid is working there. So the kid is trying to countermand orders that the other people, like it's this very complicated conspiracy nonsense thing, but they have end up having to kill each other. And the dude's like, no, look, I just went out. I'm going to go marry my bird watching lady and we're leaving. And she's like, I am hunting you and this woman down. Like, she just gets this vindictive thing, and she is after. I'm like, who in the world are you, lady? This
that
is
was
crazy.
Fun.
Like, oh, it was hilarious.
It was so, like, that idea of this G-man woman being like, I'm just going to fulfill my orders.
Yeah,
like, that's
it's like,
what
no, I was
do.
Told to kill you. I'm going to kill you. This is it. You ruined my life, man. We're done.
It was kind of funny.
So there were some very fun character twists in there
that
were worth watching.
So, thank you for listening to this episode. Because everybody liked the 21 Pilots episode, I decided that we should do more kind of talking about certain, like, weird subgenres of music and whatnot. And it seems like one thing we're going to do is episodes like this, a Siren Song, where Melissa gets to talk about things and songs.
I'll talk more next time. I wasn't very enthusiastic today, but I will talk more in the future. I think we're doing Billie Eilish next, so stay tuned for that.
Yes. I think being able to talk about storytelling in music, I think it's just a cool thing that our show is able to do and that we've kind of been able to start that conversation, talk about how like different concept albums, different stories within songs and stuff like this, where it's a musician making like something like his own kind of visual and storytelling, like little mini universe. I'm excited to do more, and You can reach us at Unboxing Story on Facebook and Twitter, or at Unboxing Story Podcast at gmail.com. Leave us a voice message.
Yes, on anchor.fm/unboxing-story. Sorry that that's that complicated. But you can search for us on there too, and there's a button to leave us a message.
Right. And you can also support us through that. We appreciate any of your donations. And I think that's about it.
And that's about it.
Please stay cool in this. Well, depending where you are.
Yeah, if you're some in Antarctica, of you might be in more fortunate areas than we are.
But,
it's hot.
Yeah,
fine. But our air conditioner works. Yay!
Yes.
Finally. It broke. And now it does not.
Yes. Thank you. And we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.